You need to pick expensive problems to solve if you want to pick a profitable niche.
Welcome to the Business of Freelancing podcast, where we help you get better clients, make more money, and live a happier and healthier life freelancing. I'm your host, Brennan Nunn, and I am back after, God, what's it been, three months or so of having this podcast go once again, unfortunately, into hibernation. Now, before I come up with my my laundry list of excuses on why that is, I do want to tell you some good news, and that is I have hired two people. I've hired my friend Kai, and I've hired another guy, Craig, who their job is to not only help me get people on this podcast, but also to help me produce it. I'm not an editor. I hate audio editing. And I've been sitting on interviews. I've been sitting, to be truthful, on this interview for a while, but I really never got myself to edit it. I always dreaded going into the editing tool and doing it. So I hired people to do that for me. So considering I'm paying them monthly on a productized retainer service, it'll hopefully encourage me to produce at least 4 episodes a month. That is my goal. One episode a week, and one article a week for my blog. And that will be the minimum requirement for each and every work week of mine. So where have I been, though? Have I been living off the grid, and retreating to the woods or, something like that? The good news is I haven't been, I haven't gone that far off the deep end yet. I've been working on this new course. I just launched it a few weeks ago, and it did really, really well. But I wanted to produce a course to retire my old product on how to get clients through your website, which was called Sell Yourself Online, The Blueprint. And I wrote this book, it must have been 3 years ago, and it was pretty much everything I knew about how to use online channels to acquire clients. And it was good. I mean, it's helped a lot of people, but I had really two big issues with it. The first issue was it wasn't comprehensive in that it didn't cover networking, it didn't cover referrals, it didn't cover job boards, it didn't cover anything else. It was very laser focused, which is a good thing to a degree. But a lot of people who read it were asking, well, this is great, Brennan, but how do I, where's your guide on networking, or where's your guide on how to solicit referrals or whatever else? So that was the one thing. And the second thing was that it was delivered as a book, which meant, one thing I've learned having done this for a while now is I routinely email past customers, and I want to see, you bought this book on how to build a better, more badass website that will get you clients. How's it going? What have you done? And a lot of the replies I was getting were things like, well, I bought the book, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet. Or I read it, it was great, but I haven't, I've been busy with client work. I haven't had a chance to really do anything yet. And that's, that's not good for me, and it's not good for them. They spent money and haven't got any value on, out of that yet. And here I am sitting on somebody's money, and they, they haven't done anything, right? Like that I want success stories. That helps me, and it helps my customers. So I scrapped the product. It was a perfectly good product. It did a fair amount of monthly revenue for me, but I got rid of it, and I replaced it with a once a year course called Double Your Freelancing Clients, which is much more comprehensive. It's much more high touch. So I've assigned each student of it a dedicated mentor who is going to basically kind of like be on top of them, help them set monthly goals, help them achieve those goals, and so on, along with make myself available to kind of answer any technical or conceptual questions about the course itself. So I launched it about a week and a half ago is when I opened up the launch window. And we've had about 200 people join. So I'm really excited to get it started. It actually kicks off next Monday, the 23rd of March. So it's probably already happened when this recording goes live. But the I'm really excited to see where this goes. But you're not here. You're not listening to hear about me or my course. Unless maybe you're a student, then it's probably of interest to you. But you're here because you want to grow your business. You want to get a better business, and you want to ultimately have better, more profitable clients. So today I've interviewed a good friend of mine, Philip Morgan, who actually Philip's a mentor in the aforementioned course, but I interviewed him about a book he recently published. And this book is called The Technical Positioning Manual. It's all about how you can position yourself as an expert to your clients. And this is something I get a lot of email about from people who just joined my list or who I've surveyed, who say, you know, they want help in positioning. How do I convince somebody that I'm an expert? How do I show them that I'm more than just a code monkey or a design monkey or a copy monkey or whatever kind of monkey you might sometimes get typecast as? So I brought Philip on to discuss a lot of the kind of topics he covers in the book. It is a great book. At the end, I'll give you more information about how to get the book if you want to pick it up. But without further ado, here's Philip. Alrighty, so I'm here with Philip Morgan. Philip, how's it going, man?
Great. How are you, Brennan?
I'm good. I'm staying warm. It's cold outside, but hope is, you know, now that it's past what, the solstice, it's going to start getting, you know, sunnier and warmer. So I'm excited.
A few minutes each day.
Well, you're out in California, right?
Yeah. So cold here is in the 30s.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm jealous. I know when I was out there, what, a few months back, and I think you had messaged me on Twitter or something because we were up over by Sonoma and your woods and everything. And I think you said you live somewhat close to there, right?
Yeah, 20 minutes from the ocean in Sonoma County. I live in a little hippie town called Sebastopol, which is like an hour north of San Francisco. And I was like, oh, we could meet up. But didn't quite work
it was,
out.
It was our anniversary trip. So my wife probably would have killed me if I met up with, like, you know, internet friend or work friend or whatever. So yeah,
as she should.
Yes, I agree. Cool. So we're not here to talk about California, though. We're here to talk about positioning, which is something you've recently, or you're working on, I believe. It's not done, right? Right. You're still kind of in the process of it.
I'm finishing up a book on the subject called The Positioning Manual for Technical Firms. Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk about positioning because I know that, like, I'm a member of your audience. So I know that your audience needs to learn as much as they can about it, because I see it as a tool that they can use to better their condition and improve their business.
So what do you mean by positioning? I mean, I've got my definition, but what do you mean by it, specifically in terms of what you're writing about?
It does tend to be kind of an all-purpose marketing term. And it sort of means whatever people want it to mean. So what I want it to mean is it's becoming 100% clear and actually rather specific about who you serve, what services you offer them, and how you do so differently than other companies who might be doing the same thing. So as we mentioned previously in the chit-chat before we started recording, it means sort of the same thing as niching down or just becoming very specific about who you advertise your services being for.
Mm-hmm. So it's not really about it's not about what you technically are good at or whatever. It's more about kind of client facing what it is you produce.
Well, it's about both.
Okay.
When I talk to people about positioning, I try to make sure they understand that when they position their company, meaning they become specific about who they serve and what they do right for them, they are not having to stop doing things that they find enjoyable. They're just focusing their marketing in a way that starts to attract clients to them because it's so specific.
Yeah, and and you've probably seen this. I actually wrote about it a few weeks ago, that concept of the allergy clinic, that the more specific they were, the better it was, both for the people who had the allergy that they were getting specific about, but it kind of bled over into everything else. Is that kind of what you mean by this?
That's exactly what I mean. Not only that, it starts to become more memorable, and that's why it made such a great example. I think that was in your newsletter that you mentioned that. it's much more memorable when you're highly specific and when you stop saying things like, I'm a full stack developer, I'm a front end developer, I'm a web developer, and you start getting specific about what problems you can solve for people, it becomes a lot more memorable.
And it's hard. I mean, God knows I've seen it. You've seen it too. The kind of cookie cutter web designers, developers who, full stack LAMP developer or, Rails developer or whatever it is. And it's kind of like, I always kind of, my issue with it is the commoditization angle, which is, there's a lot of reasons that you don't want to be the self-identified, full stack web developer. But I think I'd like to hear more about, because I know you've done you've got a lot of experience in position just from a lot of what I've been following with Sherpa and everything else.
Right.
But let me actually, just for those listening, Philip runs another company called, it's My Content Sherpa, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if My is a part of it or if it's just Content Sherpa. But, yeah. But no, I mean, so I remember when that came up on my radar, I think you had either emailed me about it or I don't know how I saw it, but I remember because I think my name was on your sales page at the time. And what was brilliant about it was how specific it was. It was very, and again, I should have glossed over because I know we're talking about positioning, but I should have looked at your Content Sherpa site before recording. But what I remember, and which is actually... coincides with what you were just saying, is the last time I saw it was probably months ago, but I still remember what you're selling. I still remember the problem that you're fixing with my client Sherpa. Whereas, if you were just a I will write blog posts for you service or freelance blogger or whatever, I wouldn't remember details. But what I do remember about it is, you're focusing on helping people who have a business and that business would or could grow substantially if they had the right kind of like audience building stuff in place, right?
Exactly. I want to go back just a minute or two and point out that I am I'm the last person who's going to criticize anybody for being a generalist, because that was me like 6 months ago.
That was all of us. That was
right? Yeah, and that's, I guess, part of why I'm so fired up about helping others understand how they can use positioning to make their business better is because I've seen it firsthand work for me. First of all, you mentioned my Content Sherpa, and that service is very specific in who it's meant for. The template of how it works and what it does could be applied to a lot of different companies, but I'll only work with technical firms, like programming consultancies, web agencies, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Even though you could work for really anyone. I mean,
I could.
Right. Because you're still, I mean, what you're doing on the back end is you're producing content, right?
Yes. And also helping my clients with their positioning.
No, right. But I mean, in general, like the technicals of what you do, and I think that's where a lot of us get hung up, is I could write code for virtually any kind of business that has code as a requirement, right?
Like, yes.
Where any kind of, and that's kind of how I initially started out, where right. What I've come to kind of realize, and I'd love to hear your input on this, is I think most of us kind of drag our resumes into our new businesses. And before, we sold ourselves on, well, I'm a web developer and you're a company looking to hire a web developer. So, how about I submit my resume to you and maybe I'll work for you full time.
Yep.
And then we go out on our own and we don't kind of, what we do is we just kind of change the legalities and say, well, instead of being a W-2 employee, I'm going to be a 1099 contractor. And we don't really change exactly what we're selling. We kind of go into it like we're selling to a prospective boss.
Not only that, I think for a lot of folks, the transition from having a job to being self-employed is not something they really saw coming. Maybe they had a boss they hated and they quit, or like me, maybe they got laid off in 2008. And you just don't have the luxury to sit around for months and collect best practices about how to run a business. You just kind of get to it, right? And you go out and you tap whatever network you've got, you ask for referrals, and that takes people sometimes quite a long ways. They can ride that referral network and that good luck and the fact that they have this broad skill set for years sometimes. But I think that what happens almost inevitably is that stops carrying them. And then they've got to actually do business development for real. And they've got to develop a pipeline and they've got to get out there and make it rain. That gets a lot easier to do when you're super specific mm-hmm. about what you do. And so I saw that firsthand with my own freelance career. I'm now 5-6 years into that. And I resisted specializing for the first 5 years because it felt safer to transfer all the risk to my clients by billing hourly and to be a marketing generalist or a content generalist, really, is what I was. I was like, I'll write anything because I'm a writer. And I did not reduce the scope of what kind of clients I wanted. And it felt safe. It felt like, well, you know, there's more clients out there if I'm general. But what I found is it's really difficult to get above, you know, let's arbitrarily say around $100 an hour as a generalist.
Generalist, right. Right. I think it's exactly what you just said, which is, you know, I think the underlying root outside of us wanting to generalize because it's more comfortable, we don't want to say no to people. And yep. when you specialize, you kind of need to say no.
You need to say no, and you also need to believe in your own value as a expert and as a specialist. And that can be challenging to do because you're used to relying on getting paid to learn as a generalist. And then as an expert, you're sort of in a different position where you should already know how to do what you're selling.
Right. So instead of, I mean, the typical kind of hourly model is, hey, like I charge $50 an hour and you can rent me and, you know, I'll just bang on my keyboard until we both mutually agree that either we've used up the budget or you have what you need built and that's it, right? Like mm-hmm. that's kind of the typical scenario, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that I hear from people when I talk about specializing is, they're afraid they're going to get bored or that they're going to make the wrong choice, that they're going to pick something to specialize in that there's not enough clients out there for it. Or, you know, they keep doing it over and over again and they fear they are going to become very bored with doing that thing.
So let me ask you this. I read a blog, the newsletter I mentioned a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
One of the comments that I remember said something like, I don't want to pigeonhole myself into a niche that is either not profitable enough or gets to be repetitive and boring over time. What would you say to that? Like, let's have you reply to her comment
sure.
you know, live over the air.
Sure. Well, there's two parts to that. The not profitable enough.
Right. And then the boring.
I mean,
part.
Well, actually the overall sentiment, I don't want to pigeonhole myself. Really, this person is saying, I don't want to make a choice that I'm going to regret later. The first thing I would say is if you do not make some choice, there's a ceiling on what you can earn. There's a ceiling on the level of power that you have in a relationship with a client. And all of that will be forever limited. So you must make a choice. That's the general position I'm coming from. Specifically, though, choosing a profitable niche, you need to do what I know anyone who's read your books understands, which is you need to think about things from the client's perspective. What problems can you solve for them that are expensive? I call them expensive problems. And I break that down a little bit further in my writing about this. Expensive problems are painful to the client. They have a sense of urgency. They need to be done now. They need to be fixed now or yesterday. Mm-hmm. And they often have an ROI or cost savings component, although not always. There are expensive problems that are just like broken plumbing. What's the ROI on fixing broken plumbing?
Right.
It's not great, but it prevents further damage. And so it can be a very urgent thing that gets, you know, that people willingly spend lots of money on. So you need to pick expensive problems to solve if you want to pick a profitable niche.
So how do you find expensive problems?
You know your clients. You talk to them. You actually talk to them about maybe more than just the scope of the project you're working on. I won't say you get to be friends with them, mm-hmm. but you get to where you can see the world from their perspective. And if you're not at that level, then that's one of the first steps I would advise people to take as a part of getting to that point, is to get to know their clients better. You can do this through research and poking around online. If your clients are, you know, talking about and complaining about things online, you know, we talk about in the marketing world pain points that a product solves. You know, as a freelancer, your service should solve, well, I say should. If you want to command premium rates, you need to look for expensive problems to solve. I'll leave it at that.
So everything you're saying is, I 100% agree with. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to continue being devil's advocate, and I'm going to channel a lot of the kind of the feedback I've gotten when I've tried to either casually or incidentally make comments like this to you. So
good. Okay.
I asked you
I'm ready.
I already asked you about the finding expensive problems.
Right.
Okay. So I've worked with a lot of different clients on a lot of different projects. There's nothing similar. There's nothing, you know, everything I do is custom. Like, do I just pick one, or do I try to get maybe generalize kind of the stuff I've done, or what do I do? In the last webinar I did, there was a guy who, kept bringing up, everything I do is 100% custom. We were talking about productized consulting. I cannot generalize. I cannot productize any of this. And, he wasn't the only one with that concern.
I am curious if he's looking too much at the input and not enough at the output. And when I say the input, I mean, yes, the code or the thing you designed was 100% custom.
Right.
Was there any pattern in the type of problem it solved?
Side note, he was, but yes. Yeah, no, I mean, and I think that's the thing is, I think a lot of us are like, well, you know, I did this custom logo in Illustrator for client A, and then for client B, I did another custom logo with different colors, different whatever. You know, that's a really bad example, but, you know, that's the kind of thinking, right, where it's, you know, either the client and their business is different, like what the client needs technically is different.
Yeah.
There's all these differences, and I think a lot of people struggle in trying to kind of say, well, let's step back and think, like, is there any common thread? Even if it's not a common thread for everyone, it's just, you know, you could find, well, what's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if you're building, let's say, a new product, you can't, there's no one product fits everyone available, right? Like that's a unicorn. However, when you find maybe two or three people who are all having that same underlying problem, that's usually a pretty good signal that there's probably more than just those two or three people. And that's a good start, at least for coming up with a kind of like an ideal customer, I guess.
Yeah. You know, I'll add on to that by saying, focusing more on your client's view of why you're talking to them, that's kind of an awkward way to say, of just focusing more on their perspective solves a number of problems. And I think it also gives you more insight into why they're on, you know, why they're contacting you. It's not just because they needed, you know, 5,000 lines of code. it's a deeper reason that's generally much more personal and has, you know, some kind of cost associated with it. So that may not sound like a great answer to that objection that you just voiced about there being no pattern, but I suspect that's part of what's going on.
Do you have any tips for, I know one of the things you're covering in the book is kind of that, the mindset confidence stuff. Mm-hmm. I what I come to kind of discovered, and this has come kind of through a lot of just email discussions with readers and customers and so on, is that I think a lot of it is, it really boils down to, it's not an inability to say, let's survey either our past customer base or the kind of people we want to work with to come up with a quote unquote product or an ideal customer with a right. specific kind of problem. I think a lot of it is, and I think this is what you brought up at the beginning, where it's still just a lot easier to just say, look, like, I know how to use this tool, just rent me by the hour and I'll mm-hmm. get it done. Because coming up with that specific solution to a type of problem kind of requires you to get more vested in the work you do, right? Like, you need to become a little more, you sometimes need to venture into territories you're unfamiliar with, which are, getting into things like success criteria and, mm-hmm. Understanding from a business perspective, like, what's at stake with this project, instead of just saying, like, look, you know, you're looking for a website. Hey, I build websites. I don't know why you want this website, but you just tell me what you want it to look like and how many right. pages it should have, and I'll do it. And yeah, that's what a lot of people, like, when they're like scratching their heads saying, why can't I make more than $1,000 on a website project? Well, the answer is that you can go onto Odesk and find anyone, like, mm-hmm. or find a lot of people who are like, yeah, for $300, I'll make you that 5-page website you're looking for that's blue. Mm-hmm. Instead of kind of leveling up a bit and becoming that kind of consultant who's saying, yeah, let's talk about the problem. And yeah, the website is going to be what fixes the problem, but it's not the reason we're doing this.
Well, I guess to that, that specific mindset, I would say, first of all, I feel you. I was there.
Again, we all have.
Yeah. And second, I would say there is no free lunch. And positioning is not some form of a free lunch that I can give you. It's not a way to change how you talk about yourself and get off the hook for the responsibility that comes with positioning yourself as an expert. So I would look the person in the eye and I would say, is freelancing a career for you? Is it something that you want to be able to allow you to support your parents in their old age? Is it something that you would actually, you would like to provide enough money to buy a house? I mean, in other words, are you serious about this as a career? Or is this something you're doing because it's the least bad option for you?
Right.
And, I would try to say this in a really kind way, but honestly, I think it comes down to that, because as soon as you use positioning as a tool to position yourself as an expert, you have got to step up. You've got to take more responsibility, and you've got to work with your client as a business partner, not as some vendor that, is going to disappear after the project is done. So I think I would not make a lot of friends doing this, but this is how I would speak to that mentality, because I think it really starts as an inner desire to level up, like you said.
Well, I do want to counter one thing you just said, and I do think that you can be a career freelancer while doing the kind of hourly grunt work forever. You're just gonna, like you mentioned earlier, you're limited. You've got a glass ceiling that you will not be able to free yourself from. And right. You're probably
you
going to
be okay
hating,
with that.
You're,
right.
you're going to start probably hating your life after a while, right?
Okay.
Like, it's not going to be great long term, at least. It might be good now just because it's easy. But I can tell you, having done both, mm-hmm. I am so much more happy when I know the value I'm bringing to my clients. And I mean the real, not just the deliverables. I'm talking about mm-hmm. How I'm changing their business, and right. And I think I think a lot of what you've been talking about so far is exactly what needs to be done to help you get there. So so you've come up with that expensive problem, that expensive thing mm-hmm. that needs to be solved. What's next?
Well, we could go two directions here. We could kind of talk more about how to come up with that expensive problem, because I think it's It's something that you can do inside of an hour. It's super easy. Or we can kind of talk about the larger picture of what you do next, which is you take that knowledge and you start to change how you talk to clients. Your choice, Brennan. What do you want to talk about more?
Pragmatically, the right thing to do would be to let's talk about how, you know, once you understand what kind of solution you can bring to the table, how do you translate that into, sales discussions and everything. So
great. Okay.
What do you do next?
So you have this crystal clear understanding of who you're trying to attract and what you want to do for them. You need to make sure that all your touch points with clients reflect that. So it's not just something it's not some vision quest you go away and do and then you're a changed person. You actually can put this into action. You need to orient your website copy around this. You need to, if you're doing any marketing, you need to start to align that marketing with your positioning. So I'll just dive into those briefly, and then we can start talking about how it translates into a sales conversation. A lot of people I find get very confused about marketing. There's a bunch of different ways to do marketing, and you might think about it from the perspective of does email perform better than social media versus pay per click or whatever, and it can be overwhelming. I think one of the beauties of positioning yourself is it sets you up to choose marketing. And when I say marketing, I don't mean marketing for its own sake. I mean marketing for the sake of developing a pipeline for your business. You can choose marketing channels based on your positioning. Your positioning says, I'm an expert. Your marketing says, this is the proof that I really am an expert. Mm-hmm. And so it gives your marketing a specific function. Your marketing is not just, quote unquote, getting the word out or, getting brand recognition. It is proving that you have the expertise that you claim to in your positioning.
So practically you're saying instead of an ad in your Yellow Pages, or not that anyone does it anymore, or banner ads or PPC ads, it's more about focusing on really good case studies and content showing that you're capable of solving these kind of problems.
Right. Now, I'm a content marketer, so I know this looks like I'm shilling for myself, but...
Well, to be honest, I'm a content marketer too, so...
But really, when you ask yourself, okay, I've made this claim of expertise in my positioning, what's going to prove that the best? Content marketing usually does stack up pretty well against other forms of marketing. When that's the question, content marketing is the answer. Mm-hmm. And I think that really is the question for the more technical end of the spectrum of professional services. They really do have to prove it. If they're saying we're the best, database performance optimization firm there is, you got to prove that to your prospects. So positioning makes your marketing gel together better. It usually makes it more effective because it's more focused on a specific audience. And as I'm sure you know, Brennan, if your marketing is diffused across too broad of an audience, it's not going to be very effective.
Yes.
In a sales conversation, it changes the dynamic. I would not recommend that someone who is just scraping by as a freelancer try to position themselves overnight as a top expert in some field, because it's going to be too hard in a sales conversation to say no to a prospective client. If that's, if you've got, if you're trying to make next month's rent with this sales conversation, it's going to be really hard to say no. And an expert says no all the time, mm-hmm. in different ways. They say no, that we're not, that's not our expertise. Let us refer you if that's really what you need, or no, that's not the right solution that you've already come to us with sketched out. Let us work together to create the right solution for you.
Right.
So positioning will require that you say no, more and more than you're used to, I suspect, unless you're just a really disagreeable person.
Yeah, and I want to also I was actually on a coaching call yesterday with somebody who is making this transition now. They're going right. from kind of like low hourly rate freelancing to higher value consulting, and they have the right kind of, they've done everything, you know, he's done everything right, and he's yeah. moving toward that. And I think he's going from a little less than 100 an hour to he's aiming for 8,000 a week, which is a pretty awesome. Big jump, right?
Yeah.
And he was saying something like, well, you know, what if all I can get, you know, what if that first client, what if I don't have the experience yet and I can only get 4,000 a week? Should I say no? Or what if I can't? And again, I think, and I've written about this before, the issue is I think a lot of people seem to think we need outside permission from somebody to say, like, can I actually go to 8,000 a week from 100 mm-hmm. an hour? The answer to anyone listening is yes, because no one else but you determines the price of your what you do.
Right.
But no, I mean, what I was trying to get to, you know, get across to him was that you don't want to, if like I could go tomorrow and say, you know what, I'm $100,000 a week. That's how much mm-hmm. I cost.
Right.
I don't think I know and have the kind of case studies and everything else to warrant anything close to that.
Right.
So I could very, if consulting was my only income, I could virtually put myself out of business overnight if I was that dogmatic about it.
Right.
But I think when it's more of a, this is the ideal kind of client I want with the ideal kind of solution or problems that I can solve, it doesn't need to be black or white. It can be, you don't need to say, I'm going to fire all my clients today and only start doing what Philip's saying I should do now. And, you know, whatever, like the yeah. last thing you should do is risk defaulting on your mortgage. But
exactly.
But I think, you know, having that kind of benchmark established and knowing this is where I want to get to, and here's how I plan on getting there. Here's how I plan on deconstructing the work I've done in the past and come up with a specific positioning statement that I can then put on my website. I can then, you know, write content around showcasing mm-hmm. my ability to solve it. As you know, with content, with anything content related, it's not going to be like we all dream of that kind of ideal banner ad that will, you know, you write, you put it up tonight, 10% of all people who click end up buying, and you know, we make bank doing that.
Right.
That's unrealistic, and especially with content, it usually takes time. Like, you know, if somebody reads a great case study of some success you deliver to your client,
yeah,
it's rare that they're going to pick up the phone right then and call you, right? Like there's a lot of stuff in between, and it can take time. Like, I mean, a lot of this, when we did seminars to do to market my agency, we did a lot of these in-person seminars. The feedback loop, the loop between somebody seeing a seminar of ours and becoming a client, could be months.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that needs to be taken into account also.
Yeah. And what's important in those kind of time delays is that people even remember you, which it gets back to being specific. Two things I want to say about what you just said. I agree with you. I would never recommend that someone, you know, do the positioning, quote unquote, vision quest and say, I've got it. We need to be doing something totally different. Fire all the clients.
Fire everyone and start new on Monday. Yeah.
Start small. Yeah, start small. In fact, I know one of the running threads in your podcast and your writing is productized services. And that's a great way to start small, is to say, you know what, we've got some clarity about what we want to do. We think it's going to translate to higher rates. Start with a service instead of your, you know, betting your whole company on that.
Right.
It still can get you where you're going. It may not be as fast. It may not be as exciting and dramatic, but I bet it's a lot more prudent way to grow a business.
That's right.
The other thing I wanted to mention is back to the idea of what happens in a sales conversation. When you've been positioning yourself as a very focused expert, clients automatically trust you more from the get-go. They don't have to test you as much. When I say clients, I mean prospective clients, because they are reassured that you have one job, and that one job is a very focused job. It's not a jack of all trades job. And I think when you're wearing that jack of all trades hat, clients will test you a little more to make sure that you're really competent before they hire you.
I And I think what I would say there is, and I've used this example before, so forgive me if you've heard it before, is the idea that let's say that a client needs, say they've got this big board and they need a nail drilled into an exact location on that board. Mm-hmm. And you are a professional hammer swinger who can nail stuff in to boards. A lot of the sales discussion is, can Philip actually put the nail in the place I need it to go on this board? Like he swings hammers, but can he put the nail where I need it to be? Whereas if you're marketing, if you're selling, hey, I put nails only in the top right corner of boards, and they're like, oh, that's exactly where I need the nail to go. A lot of that sales, the stuff that usually comes through a sales discussion doesn't need to happen because you're telling them, you're assuaging a lot of those concerns. Like, can he put the nail where I need it to be? Or,
yeah,
you know, you're the one saying, I can put the nail where you need it. And if you need it here, I'm your guy.
That's a fantastic example. And you will still get people who say, I need a nail a little more towards the center of the board. I mean, basically in the top right, but a little more towards the center. And you can decide as someone who's positioned themselves as an expert, you can decide whether to talk to them. Maybe it's close enough of a fit that you can really knock it out of the park for them. We'll do it. But it doesn't mean you'll never hear from those people who want the nail 2 inches away from where you put it in. I love that example, Brennan. That's really good.
Well, I mean, it's. I wanted to. Again, I think given time, it could probably be a little more practical. but what I like about that example too is that I think a lot of us are like either the client buys exactly what we're offering or they don't. Mm-hmm. There is that gray area, and like you just said, if you had a customer who came to you and they're like 90% your ideal customer, you're probably not going to turn them away just because they don't fit the exact kind of like archetype that you're writing to, you know, toward on your site, right? Like, I mean,
exactly.
Again, you're offering a service. It's one thing to say, you know, you have a product company and you've got a product and there's a factory building widgets. And if, you know, your widget only works with a specific kind of component, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But ultimately even though you're selling it more like a product that solves a problem, mm-hmm. it's still amenable. And I think that trips up a lot of people where they say, well, you know, again, I don't want to back myself into a corner. I don't want to just become an assembly line doing the same thing over and over. And it sounds like surface level can sound like a lot of this stuff we've been talking about kind of makes you this kind of like, you know, factory worker where all you do is you do one thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And I think that actually harkens back to that objection that I relayed early on this discussion, which is, well, I don't want to get bored doing the same thing. I don't want to get bored writing content for the same kind of company over and over and over. I want to have variety.
Right. But this is a little bit of an overly dramatic way to respond to that. But I always ask people who gets up on the stage at TED and gives talks. I'm not talking about TEDx, which is a little more
open,
a little less selective. Yeah, a little right. more open. But you know, the real thing or any major conference is it people who've been dabbling in 10 different things. Sometimes, I guess, if they have something really interesting that they've learned from that, but usually it is an expert who has been focused on one thing and they've gone so deep into it, they've discovered something fascinating that makes for a good talk. That's, I think, a much more accurate portrayal of what it's like to be an expert. Not that you're going to be up on the stage at TED, but that is the life of an expert is much more interesting than I think people realize. So that's how I tend to respond to that. Because I think we demonize things we don't understand, and expertise is one of those things most people don't understand.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I would think that, I mean, expertise could be a subject to itself to discuss, but what I found, and this is something I struggled with early on, which is, well, how can I, you know, I know I'm not an absolute expert at at consulting. So what gives me the right to attempt to make a business in helping people consult better? But when you realize it's expertise is relative, and when you realize you just need to be an expert, especially with consulting, when you're talking about 5-6 figure deals, you need to be an expert for a handful of people. It's not about being this, I mean, great if you become this world renowned expert at something, but, and I think that's why content is so great, because if you get somebody who, let's say they read a case study on, some way that you've helped a small business become more profitable through a really smart, well thought out content strategy, you could educate them on, well, what does content marketing mean? Actually, a really good example of this is, and you might have heard this example, is Patrick McKenzie, when he was trying to sell a big Fortune 500 on split testing services, on conversion services. They had ended up reading a lot of his content on his blog, and they even bought his course on lifecycle email writing and everything. Yeah. When they were courting him about potentially him consulting for them, there was a IBM bigwig who was also vying for the product or for the project. Unfortunately for the IBM guy, Patrick got to them first and kind of established Patrick's way of doing conversion optimization and writing lifecycle emails and everything else. And he influenced them, or he influenced rather the stakeholder over time through his content, which when it got to the point where proposals were being issued, they rejected the IBM guy because he didn't, his idea of what conversion optimization is, isn't what Patrick's idea is, right? So he had a differing opinion of how it should work than Patrick had. And, but Patrick was able to, you know, again, you know, over time and at scale, influence them through content. And I think that's really what it harkens back to, is just this idea of becoming an expert in the eye of a prospective client or even a prospective refer to, you know, for you. And, you know, and letting, you know, being consistent, pushing out content. And again, this is kind of, I think, outside of the scope of this discussion, but I think it's still important to talk about, like, the, you know, how important it is with, especially with positioning yourself as an expert to somebody. I think a lot of us just assume that the sales cycle is very fast. It's very much, somebody stumbles upon your marketing site, they click on your contact me link, they email you, they say, let's go, you get on a phone call, whatever. Usually, and I'm sure this is true of your business, usually the life cycle is much longer.
I have, even for my productized service, which is, it can be customized a bit, but it's basically not a thing that I customize very much. I've had the sales cycle be 6 months. The service itself is only 8 months old. So it, I mean, that's a pretty long sales cycle. But the background communication that can happen through a steady stream of content marketing is, can close the deal in cases like that. It can build up the level of trust in the prospect enough that, that it's kind of becomes a no-brainer at some point. So yeah, absolutely. I love that Patrick example because, well, I guess because it proves my point that, you know, there's a great example. He made a claim of expertise in the field of A/B testing. And, you know, when it came down to it, it was the fact that he backed that up through his marketing. And he could have perhaps achieved that same goal through a different type of marketing, but content marketing is great because, like you mentioned, it can it's got great scalability.
Right, exactly. He doesn't, you know, you can have a 3-year-old blog post that's still selling for you, which doesn't happen in any other, like, you know, you can't have your sales call with a prospective client from 3 years ago still be effective, you know, today. Which is, Okay, so let's, I want to close with, so we talked about, first off, what is positioning? And then we talked about how, conceptually, how that affects what it is you do. I want to tackle that last concern, which was the concern of, well, you know, I like how I get to work on all these fun and exciting projects for all these different kinds of companies with all these different kinds of problems. Can you still maintain that excitement even when you really laser focus in on a specific problem?
I think so. I think there's two ways that happens. I think everyone is familiar with the idea of a fractal. You know, the closer you, it's this sort of thing that becomes, no matter how close you get to it, there's still this unfolding level of intricacy and detail, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a visual metaphor, but I think it applies to expertise. I gotta say that was one of my concerns about my content Sherpa, was that it would become boring. And I'm 8 months into it. I know that's not the same as being 8 years into a specialty, but let me tell you, it has not become boring, because the closer I get to what I'm focused on, the more interesting little things I discover to learn about and to make better. And there's always side projects. You can always do things that are interesting and fun without doing them while being paid for your clients. And actually, I would kind of throw that question back in the face of the questioner and say, who can afford to take time off to do a side project? Someone making $100 an hour or someone making $300 an hour? Who can afford that better? So I think you do not need to sacrifice having a diverse, enjoyable career. You just have to be disciplined about what you charge money for and what you don't.
And I mean, I know people who offer a very specifically positioned product or service, who will routinely upsell customers who bought into it because it's much easier to buy a product that solves a specific problem than it is to buy a worker who can potentially solve that problem, who will then upsell, you know, out of the scope of whatever the, you know, it's usually often a recurring engagement where you pay, you know, a few thousand a month, who will upsell bigger out of scope things, right, to their clients that they get through this channel. So that's one thing. And on top of that, the other thing I would say is, you know, there's nothing in the world saying, you know, you, Philip Morgan, can only work on my content Sherpa. Like, there's no other productized service you can do simultaneously. That's just not true. I mean, you can. I mean, there's nothing keeping you from, I wouldn't recommend it, but becoming like a social media manager service type thing, right? Like, you could do both, as long as you just have a very clear cut. Like, this is what it is you're getting. This is how I'm selling it to you, and this is how I'm fulfilling. There's nothing keeping you from offering both, or even doing typical like whatever kind of consulting, right? Like the normal stuff most of us do.
Exactly.
It's not all or nothing, I think, is probably what I would say, and I'm sure you would agree with.
I do agree with that. Once a client or a potential client is in contact with me, we can explore a number of ways of working together, and they don't all have to be an exact black and white match for my positioning. Just as long as they understand the risk and I understand the risk and we're both okay with the risk, then there's a lot of flexibility there, a lot of latitude.
Have you gotten people who have seen My Content Sherpa and are kind of quote unquote sold by that, but want something different, and you've done that?
Yes. An example of that would be really a slightly different starting point. They want to get to the same endpoint, but maybe they don't have a website. Mm-hmm. And so we spend some time up front creating website content so that they actually have, you know, a shingle out there on the internet where they can hang their content marketing off of.
Right.
Like, that's an example. It's not wildly out of scope. It just requires that that we change what we do for the first month or two, get that done, and then we kind of get back to the regular plan.
Right. Yeah, and that makes total sense. I mean, it's something that I know I've seen this time and time again where people, they'll have something specific like that allergy clinic, and their fears going into it are, oh my God, everyone's going to get turned away. Like, who doesn't fit this profile?
Right.
And then they realize the opposite, and they end up getting higher paid work. They get clients who respect their ability as a problem solver, which is, I think, what we all want. We all want that kind of creative freedom that comes with the respect only an expert gets.
Right.
And and everyone's happier, right?
Yeah. The specific service gives people a focal point, and they come in via that focal point. And then what happens next is up to you.
Right. Exactly. Cool. Yeah. So let's talk let's close now with where people can find more about both you, with My Content Sherpa and everything else you do. Specifically as it relates to this call, about your new book.
Great. I don't care if people find out about me, but here's what I do care about. I put together some resources on positioning. It's like sort of my passion over the past couple months to help people with positioning. So I put together a page of resources for your listeners, Brennan, and it's a bit.ly link. If you go to bit.ly/PMCBOF, Philip Morgan Consulting, Business of Freelancing. So PMCBOF, and whatever notes you have for this podcast, I'm sure you can fit a little bit.ly link in there somewhere.
Yeah. No, that's perfect.
What they're going to find there is some resources on positioning, some stuff they can read, and then I'm giving away some copies of this book I'm working on. It'll be out the end of January. So if people sign up for this giveaway, I'm giving away 10 free copies, and they can get it for free, or they can pre-order, or whatever. But really, my hope is not that people will admire me or find out about me, but think about whether now is the time for them to position their business. I think for a good portion of people, now is the time. 2015 is the year that they can start to, really sharpen what they're trying to do and start delivering more value for their clients.
I would agree.
So
fully agree.
That's my, yeah.
And I think people, I mean, you're in the Freelancers Guild, so people can reach out to you there too if they're
totally there. Yeah.
Yep. Awesome, Philip. Well, thank you so much. Great talking to you. And I'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks, Brennan.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Philip. If you want to find more about Philip, you can go to philipmorganconsulting.com. And actually, if you go to the top right navigation and click Authority Research or Resource Center, and then the Positioning Manual for Technical Firms, you can find the book that I mentioned throughout the interview and also in the intro. So before you go, if you haven't yet written a review on iTunes or Stitcher, I would love for that to happen. The reason I would love for that to happen is, to be honest, podcasting analytics kind of sucks. I have no idea who's listening, whether they're people are getting value out of it or whatever else. And whenever I get a review and I notice it come in, it really does inspire me to keep this going. And to be honest, now that I'm going to be spending a pretty sizable amount of money producing this podcast each week, I really need to make sure that I'm getting, that it's worthwhile, right? Like that people are getting results out of it and getting value out of it and everything else. So leave a review if you like the show. I do read every review that comes in. And thank you again. And we'll be back again, hopefully in a week, for another exciting edition of the Business of Freelancing podcast.